a bridge group, no hunting buddies or luncheon pals. Like Lydia, no real friends. Hannah and Nath recognize a few professors from the university, their father's teaching assistant. But most of the faces in the chairs are strangers. Why are they even here? Nath wonders. And when the service starts and they all crane their necks toward the coffin at the front, under the sassafras tree, he understands. They are drawn by the spectacle of sudden death. For the past week, ever since the police dragged the lake, the headlines in the Middlewood Monitor have all been about Lydia. Oriental girl found drowned in pond. The minister looks like President Ford, flat-browed, white-toothed, clean-cut, and solid. The Lees do not attend church, but the funeral home had recommended him, and James had accepted without asking any questions. Now James sits up straight, pressing the chairs back into his shoulder blades, and tries to listen to the service. The minister reads the 23rd Psalm, but in the revised text. I have everything I need, instead of, I shall not want. Even if I walk through a very dark valley, instead of, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. It feels disrespectful. A corner cut. Like burying his daughter in a plywood box. What else could you expect from this town? He thinks. On his right, the scent of the lilies on the casket hits Marilyn like a warm, wet fog, and she nearly retches. For the first time, she wishes she were the sort of woman, like her mother, who carried a handkerchief. She would have pressed it to her face and let it filter the air. And when she lowered it, the cloth would be dirty pink, the color of old bricks. Beside her, Hannah knits her fingers. She would like to worm her hand into her mother's lap, but she doesn't dare. Nor does she dare look at the coffin. Lydia is not inside, she reminds herself, taking a deep breath. Only her body. But then where is Lydia herself? Everyone is so still that to the birds floating overhead, she thinks, they must look like a cluster of statues. Out of the corner of his eye, Nath spots Jack sitting at the edge of the crowd beside his mother. He imagines grabbing Jack by the shirt collar to find out what he knows. For the past week, his father has called the police every morning asking for new information. But Officer Fisk says only, over and over, that they are still investigating. If only the police were here now, Nath thinks. Should he tell his father? Jack stares at the ground in front of him, as if he is too ashamed to look up. And then, when Nath himself glances back to the front, the coffin has already been lowered into the ground. The polished wood, the white lilies fastened to its top, vanished, just like that. Nothing but the blank space where it had once stood. He's missed it all. His sister is gone. Something wet touches his neck. He reaches up to wipe it away and discovers that his whole face is wet, that he's been crying silently. On the other side of the crowd, Jack's blue eyes are suddenly fixed on him, and Nath blots his cheek in the crook of his arm. The mourners begin to leave, a thin line of backs filing toward the parking area and the street. A few of Nath's classmates, like Miles Fuller, give him a sympathetic glance, but most, embarrassed by his tears, decide not to speak to him and turn away. They won't have another chance. In light of Nath's high grades and the tragic situation, the principal will exempt him from the last 3 weeks of school, and Nath himself will decide not to attend commencement. Some of the neighbors circle the Lees, squeezing their arms and murmuring condolences. A few of them pat Hannah on the head, as if she's a tiny child or a dog. Except for Janet Wolfe, her usual white doctor's coat replaced by a trim black suit, James and Marilyn don't recognize most of them. By the time Janet reaches her, Marilyn's palms feel grimy, her whole body dirty, like a rag passed from hand to soiled hand, and she can barely stand Janet's touch on her elbow. On the other side of the grave, Jack stands off to the side, waiting for his mother, half hidden in the shadow of a big elm. Nath weaves his way over, cornering him against the tree trunk, and Hannah, trapped at her parents' side by a thicket of adults, watches her brother nervously. "What are you doing here?" Nath demands. Up close, he can see that Jack's shirt is dark blue, not black. That though he's wearing dress pants, he still has on his old black and white tennis shoes with the hole in the toe. "Hey," Jack says, eyes still on the ground. "Nath, how are you?" "How do you think I am?" Nate's voice cracks, and he hates himself for it. "I gotta go," Jack says. "My mom is waiting." A pause. "I'm really sorry about your sister." He turns away, and Nath catches him by the arm. "Are you?" He's never grabbed anyone before, and he feels tough doing it, like a detective in a movie. "You know, the police want to talk to you." People are beginning to stare. James and Marilyn hear their son's raised voice and look around, but he doesn't care. He leans in closer, almost to Jack's nose. "Look, I know she was with you that Monday." For the first time, Jack looks Nath in the face, a flash of startled blue eyes. "She told you?" Nath lurches forward so that he and Jack are chest to chest. Blood throbs in his right temple. "She didn't have to tell me. Do you think I'm stupid?"
"Look, Nath,"
Jack mumbles,
"if Lydia told you that I..."
He breaks off suddenly, as Nath's parents and Dr. Wolfe come within earshot. Nath stumbles backward a few steps, glaring at Jack, at his father for interrupting, at the elm tree itself for not being farther away.
"Jack," Dr. Wolfe says sharply, "everything all right?"
"Fine,"
Jack glances at Nath, then at the adults.
"Mr. Lee, Mrs. Lee, I'm very sorry for your loss."
"Thank you for coming," says James.
He waits until the Wolfes have started down the curving path out of the cemetery before grabbing Nath by the shoulder.
"What's the matter with you?" he hisses. "Picking a fight at your sister's funeral."
Behind his mother, Jack gives a quick backward glance, and when his gaze meets Nath's, there's no doubt. He is frightened. Then he turns the curve and is gone. Nath lets out his breath.
"That bastard knows something about Lydia. You don't go around making trouble. You let the police do their work."
"James," Marilyn says, "don't shout." She touches her fingers to her temple as if she has a headache and closes her eyes. To Nath's horror, a dark drop of blood runs down the side of her face.
"No, it's only a tear, stained black by mascara, leaving a dirty gray trail on her cheek."
Hannah, her small heart awash in pity, reaches up to take her hand. But her mother doesn't notice. In a moment, Hannah contents herself by clasping her own fingers behind her back. James fishes in his jacket pocket for his keys.
"I'm taking your mother and sister home. When you've cooled off, you can walk."
As the words leave his mouth, he winces. Deep inside, he wants more than anything to calm Nath, to put a comforting and weighty hand on his shoulder,
to fold him into his arms on this day of all days. But already it takes all his strength to keep his own face from crumpling, to stop his own knees from buckling and spilling him to the ground. He turns away and grabs Hannah's arm. Hannah, at least, always does what she's told. Nath sinks down on the roots of the elm and watches his parents head back toward the car, Hannah trailing after them with one wistful backward glance. His father doesn't know what Jack is like. Jack has lived down the street from them for 11 years, since he and Nath were in the first grade, and to Nath's parents, he is just a neighbor boy, the scruffy one with the dog and that old second-hand car. In school, though, everyone knows. Every few weeks, a different girl. Every girl, the same story. Jack doesn't date. There are no dinners out, no flowers, no boxes of chocolates and cellophane wrap. He simply drives the girl out to the point or the drive-in or a parking lot somewhere and spreads a blanket across the back seat of his car. A week or two later, he stops calling and moves on. He's known to make a specialty of deflowering virgins. At school, the girls are proud of it, like they've joined an exclusive club. Clustered at their lockers, they whisper a giggling, salacious play-by-play. Jack himself talks to no one. It's common knowledge that he's alone most of the time. His mother works night shifts at the hospital 6 nights a week. He does not eat in the school cafeteria. He does not go to the dances. In class, he sits in the back row, picking the next girl he'll ask for a ride. This spring, he had picked Lydia. Nath huddles in the cemetery an hour, 2 hours, three, watching the cemetery workers stack the folding chairs, gather the flowers, pluck balled-up papers and tissues from the grass. In his mind, he dredges up every single thing he's ever heard about Jack. Every fact, every rumor. The two begin to blur. And by the time he is ready to head home, he is bubbling with a terrible fury. He tries to imagine Lydia with Jack. Tries desperately not to picture them together. Had Jack hurt her somehow? He doesn't know. He knows only that Jack is at the heart of everything, and he promises himself he will find out how. Only when the gravediggers lift their shovels and approach the open grave does Nath clamber to his feet and turn away. As he skirts the edge of the lake and turns onto their street, he spots a police car parked outside Jack's house. About goddamn time, Nath thinks. He sidles closer to the house, slouching below the line of windows. Behind the screen, the front door stands open, and he climbs the porch stairs on his toes, sticking to the edges of the worn boards, making sure they don't squeak. It's his sister they're talking about, he tells himself with each step. He has every right. At the top, he leans toward the screen door. He can't see anything except the entryway, but he can hear Jack in the living room, explaining slowly, loudly, as if it's the second or third time. She had skipped ahead into physics. Her mom wanted her in with the juniors. You were in that class. Aren't you a senior? I told you, Jack says, impatient. I had to take it over. I failed. Dr. Wolf's voice now. He has a B+ in the class this term. I told you you'd do fine if you would just do the work, Jack. Outside, Nath blinks. Jack? A B+? A rustle, as if the policeman has turned the page of a notebook. Then,
what was the nature of your relationship with Lydia?
The sound of his sister's name in the policeman's voice. So crisp and official, as if it were nothing more than a label, startles Nath. It seems to startle Jack, too. There's a sharpness to his tone that wasn't there before.
We were friends. That's all.
Several people said they saw the two of you together after school in your car.
I was teaching her to drive.
Nath wishes he could see Jack's face. Didn't they know he must be lying? But the policeman seems to accept this.
When was the last time you saw Lydia?
The policeman asks now.
Monday afternoon, before she disappeared.
What were you doing?
We were sitting in my car and smoking.
Pause as the policeman makes a note of this.
And you were at the hospital, Mrs. Wolf?
Doctor.
The policeman coughs gently. Pardon me, Dr. Wolf. You were at work?
I usually take the evening shift, every day except Sundays.
Did Lydia seem upset on Monday?
Another pause before Jack responds.
Lydia was always upset.
Because of you,
Nath thinks. His throat is so tight the words can't squeeze through. The edges of the door waver and blur like a heat mirage. He digs his fingernail into his palm, hard, until the doorway sharpens again.
Upset about what?
Upset about everything.
Jack's voice is lower now, almost a sigh.
About her grades, about her parents, about her brother leaving for college. Lots of things.
He sighs then for real. And when he speaks again, his voice is brittle, ready to snap.
How should I know?
Nath backs away from the door and creeps down the stairs.
He doesn't need to hear any more.
At home, not wanting to see anyone, he slips upstairs to his room to ruminate over what he's heard.
There is no one for him to see, anyway.
While Nath fretted under the elm tree, his family has dispersed. During the car ride, Marilyn doesn't look at James once, focusing instead on her knuckles, picking at her cuticles, fiddling with the strap of her handbag. As soon as they come inside, Marilyn says she wants to lie down, and Hannah, too, vanishes into her room without a word. For a moment, James considers joining Marilyn in their bedroom. He's filled with a deep longing to burrow against her, to feel her weight and warmth surrounding him, shielding him from everything else, to cling to her and feel her cling to him and let their bodies comfort each other. But something scratches and scratches at the edge of James's mind, and at last he lifts his keys from the table again. There is something he must do at the office. Urgently. It cannot wait another minute. When the police had asked if he wanted a copy of the autopsy, he had given them his office address. Then, yesterday, a thick manila envelope appeared in his mail cubby, and he decided he'd made a mistake. He didn't want to see it. Ever. At the same time, he could not bring himself to throw it away. Instead, he slipped it into the bottom drawer of his desk and locked it. It would be there, he thought, if he ever changed his mind. He had never expected to. It is lunchtime and the office is almost empty. Only Myrna, the department secretary, still sits at her desk, changing the ribbon of her typewriter. All the other office doors are shut, their frosted glass windows dim. Now James unlocks the drawer, takes a deep breath, and slits the envelope open with his finger. He has never seen an autopsy report before, and expects charts and diagrams. But it opens like a teacher's progress report. The subject is a well-developed, well-nourished Oriental female. It tells him things he already knows. that she was 16 years old, 65 inches tall, that her hair was black, that her eyes were blue. It tells him things he hadn't known. The circumference of her head, the length of each limb, that a small crescent moon scarred her left knee. It tells him that there were no intoxicants in her blood, that there were no signs of foul play or sexual trauma, but that suicide, homicide, or accident could not yet be determined. The cause of death was asphyxia by drowning. And then it begins in earnest. The chest is opened using a Y-shaped incision. He learns the color and size of each of her organs, the weight of her brain, that a white foam had bubbled up through her trachea and covered her nostrils and mouth like a lace handkerchief, that her alveoli held a thin layer of silt as fine as sugar, that her lungs had marbled dark red and yellow-gray as they starved for air, that like dough, they took the impression of a fingertip, that when they were sectioned with a scalpel, water flowed out, that in her stomach were snippets of lake-bottom weeds, sand, and 6 ounces of lake water she'd swallowed as she sank, that the right side of her heart had swollen, as if it had had too much to hold, that from floating head down in the water, the skin of her head and neck had reddened to her shoulders, that due to the low temperature of the water, she had not yet decomposed, but that the skin of her fingertips was just beginning to peel off, like a glove. The office air conditioning clicks on, and a cool breeze floats up from the floor. His whole body trembles, as if he's caught a sudden, lasting chill. With his toe, he closes the vent, but he can't keep his hands from shaking. He balls them into fists and clenches his jaw to stop his teeth from chattering. In his lap, the autopsy report quivers like something alive. He can't imagine telling Marilyn that these things could happen to a body they loved. He doesn't ever want her to know. Better to leave it as the police summed it up. Drowning. No details to catch in the crevices of her mind. The air conditioning shuts off, silence ballooning to fill the room, then the whole department. The weight of everything he's read settles on him, crushing him to his chair. It is too heavy. He cannot even lift his head. Professor Lee? It's Louisa at the door, still wearing the black dress she'd worn at the funeral that morning.
Oh, she says. I'm so sorry. I didn't think you'd come in after...
She stops.
It's okay.
His voice crackles at the edges like old leather. Louisa slips into the room, leaving the door ajar.
Are you all right?
She takes in his red-rimmed eyes, the slouch of his shoulders, the manila envelope in his lap. Then she comes to stand beside him and gently takes the papers from his hands.
You shouldn't be here, she says, setting them on his desk.
James shakes his head. With one hand, he holds out the report. Louisa looks down at the sheaf of papers and hesitates.
Read,
James says, or tries to say. No sound emerges. But to him it seems Louisa hears anyway. She nods, leans against the edge of the desk, and bends her head over the pages. Her face doesn't change as she reads, but she grows stiller and stiller, until at the end of the report, she rises and takes James's hand.
You shouldn't be here,
Louisa says again. It's not a question. With her other hand, she touches the small of his back, and he can feel her warmth through his shirt. Then she says,
Why don't you come to my apartment? I'll cook you some lunch.
And he nods. Her apartment is a third floor walk-up, only 6 blocks from campus. Outside apartment 3A, Louisa hesitates, just for a moment. Then she unlocks the door and lets them in, and leads him straight to the bedroom. Everything about her is different. The flex of her limbs, the texture of her skin, even her taste is different, slightly tangy, like citrus, as he touches his tongue to hers. When she kneels over him to undo the buttons of his shirt, her hair curtains her face. James closes his eyes then, lets out a long, shuddering sigh. Afterward, he falls asleep with Louisa still atop him. Since Lydia was found, the only word he can bear to use for it, the little sleep he's had has been restless. In his dreams, no one but him remembers what has happened to Lydia. He alone is acutely aware, and over he must persuade Marilyn, Nath, complete strangers, that his daughter is dead. I saw her body. One of her blue eyes was gone. Now, still slick to Louisa with sweat, he sleeps soundly for the first time in days. A dreamless sleep. His mind, for the moment, gone blissfully blank. At home, in their bedroom, Marilyn, too, wills her mind to go blank. But nothing happens. For hours, trying to sleep, she has been counting the flowers on her pillowcase. Not the big red poppies that sprawl across the cotton, but the blue forget-me-nots of the background pattern. The chorus dancers behind the divas. She keeps losing track, moving from 89 back down to 80, crossing a fold in the fabric and forgetting which are accounted for, which have yet to be numbered. By the time she reaches 200, she knows that sleep is impossible. She can't keep her eyes closed. Even blinking makes her jittery. Whenever she tries to lie still, her mind whirs to life like an overwound toy. Upstairs, there is no sound from Hannah. Downstairs, no sign of Nath. At last, just as James sinks into sleep across town, she rises and goes where her thoughts have been all this time. Lydia's room. It still smells like Lydia. Not just the powdery flowers of her perfume, or the clean scent of shampoo on her pillowcase, or the trace of cigarette smoke. Karen smokes, Lydia had explained when Marilyn sniffed suspiciously one day. It gets all on my clothes and books and everything. No. When Marilyn breathes in deep, she can smell Lydia herself under all those surface layers. The sour, sweet smell of her skin. She could spend hours here, drawing the air up and holding it against her palate like the bouquet of a fine wine, drinking her in. In this room, a deep ache suffuses her, as if her bones are bruised. Yet it feels good, too. Everything here reminds her of what Lydia could have been. Prince of Leonardo's Vitruvian Man, of Marie Curie holding up a vial, every poster she'd given to Lydia since she was a child, still hung proudly on the wall. Since childhood, Lydia had wanted to be a doctor, just as her mother once had. Last summer, she'd even taken a biology course at the college so that she could skip ahead into physics. On the bulletin board hang blue ribbons from years of science fairs, an illustrated periodic table, a real stethoscope that Marilyn had special ordered for her 13th birthday. The bookshelf is so full of books that some are crammed in sideways at the top. A Brief History of Medicine, she reads upside down. Rosalind Franklin and DNA. All the books Marilyn had given her over the years to inspire her, to show her what she could accomplish. Everywhere, evidence of her daughter's talent and ambition. A fine layer of dust has already begun to coat everything. For a long time, Lydia had shooed her out when she came to vacuum and dust and tidy. "I'm busy, Mom," she had said, tapping the tip of her pen against her textbook. And Marilyn would nod and kiss her on the head and shut the door behind her. Now there is no one to turn her away. But she looks at Lydia's boot, tipped on its side on the carpet, thinks of her daughter kicking it off, and lets it lie. Somewhere in this room, she is sure, is the answer to what happened. And there, on the bottom shelf of the bookcase, she sees the neat row of diaries lined up by year. Marilyn had given Lydia her first diary the Christmas she was 5, a flowered one with gilt edges and a key lighter than a paperclip. Her daughter had unwrapped it and turned it over and over in her hands, touching the tiny keyhole as if she didn't know what it was for. "For writing down your secrets," Marilyn had said with a smile. And Lydia had smiled back up at her and said, "But Mom, I don't have any secrets." At the time, Marilyn had laughed. What secrets could a daughter keep from her mother anyway? Still, every year she gave Lydia another diary. Now she thinks of all those crossed-out phone numbers, that long list of girls who said they barely knew Lydia at all, of boys from school, of strange men who might lurch out of the shadows. With one finger, she tugs out the last diary, 1977. It will tell her, she thinks, everything Lydia no longer can. Who she had been seeing. Why she had lied to them. Why she went down to the lake. The key is missing, but Marilyn jams the tip of a ballpoint into the catch and forces the flimsy lock open. The first page she sees, April 10th, is blank. She checks May 2nd, the night Lydia disappeared. Nothing. Nothing for May 1st, or anything in April, or anything in March. Every page is blank. She takes down 1976, 1975, 1974. Page after page of visible, obstinate silence. She leafs backward all the way to the very first diary, 1966. Not one word. All those years of her daughter's life unmarked. Nothing to explain anything. Across town, James wakes in a blurry haze. It's almost evening, and Louisa's apartment has grown dim. "I have to go," he says, dizzy with the thought of what he has done. And Louisa wraps herself in the sheet and watches him dress. Under her gaze, his fingers grow clumsy. He misbuttons his shirt not once, but twice, and even when he gets it on properly, it doesn't feel right. It hangs strangely, pinching him under the arms, bulging at his belly. "How did you say goodbye after something like this?" "Good night," he says finally, lifting his bag. And Louisa says simply, "Good night," as if they're leaving the office, as if nothing has happened. Only in the car, when his stomach begins to rumble, does he realize there'd been no lunch at Louisa's apartment, that he had never actually expected there to be. And while James clicks on his headlights and eases the car into motion, stunned at how much has happened in one day, his son peers through his bedroom window in the growing dimness, staring out at Jack's house, where the porch light has just turned on, where the police car has long since pulled away. Up in the attic, Hannah curls up in her bed, sifting through each detail of the day. The white spot on each of her father's knuckles as he grasped the steering wheel. The tiny beads of sweat that clung to the minister's upper lip, like dew. The soft thump the coffin made as it touched the bottom of the grave. The small figure of her brother, spied through the west-facing window of her room, rising slowly from Jack's front steps and trudging home, head bowed. And the faint, questioning creak of her mother's bedroom door opening, answered by the quiet click of Lydia's door latching shut. She has been in there for hours. Hannah wraps her arms around herself and squeezes, imagines comforting her mother, her mother's arms comforting her in return. Marilyn, unaware that her youngest is listening so closely, so longingly, blots her eyes and replaces the diaries on the shelf and makes herself a promise. She will figure out what happened to Lydia. She will find out who is responsible. She will find out what went wrong. 4. Just before Marilyn had given Lydia that first diary, the university had held its annual Christmas party. Marilyn had not wanted to go. All fall, she'd been wrestling a vague discontentment. Nath had just started the first grade. Lydia had just started nursery school. Hannah had not yet even been imagined. For the first time since she'd been married, Marilyn found herself unoccupied. She was 29 years old, still young, still slender, still smart, she thought. She could go back to school now, at last, and finish her degree, do everything she'd planned before the children came along. Only now she couldn't remember how to write a paper, how to take notes. It seemed as vague and hazy as something she had done in a dream. How could she study when dinner needed cooking, when Nath needed to be tucked in, when Lydia wanted to play? She leafed through the help wanted ads in the paper. But they were all for waitresses, accountants, copywriters. Nothing she knew how to do. She thought of her mother, the life her mother had wanted for her, the life her mother had hoped to lead herself. Husband, children, house. Her sole job to keep it all in order. Without meaning to, she'd acquired it. There was nothing more her mother could have wished her. The thought did not put her in a festive mood. James, however, had insisted that they put in an appearance at the Christmas party. He was up for tenure in the spring, and appearances mattered. So they had asked Vivian Allen from across the street to babysit Nath and Lydia, and Marilyn put on a peach cocktail dress and her pearls, and they headed to the crepe-papered gymnasium, where a Christmas tree had been erected on the mid-court line. Then, after the obligatory round of hellos and how are yous, she retreated to the corner, nursing a cup of rum punch. That was where she ran into Tom Lawson. Tom brought her a slice of fruitcake and introduced himself. He was a professor in the chemistry department. He and James had worked together on the thesis committee of a double-majoring student who'd written about chemical warfare in World War I. Marilyn tensed against the inevitable questions. "And what do you do, Marilyn?" But instead, they exchanged the usual benign civilities. How old the children were, how nice this year's Christmas tree looked. And when he began to tell her about the research he was doing, something to do with the pancreas and artificial insulin, she interrupted to ask if he needed a research assistant. And he stared at her over his plate of pigs and blankets. Marilyn, afraid of seeming unqualified, offered a flood of explanations. She had been a chemistry major at Radcliffe, and she'd been planning on medical school, and she hadn't quite finished her degree yet, but now that the children were a bit older, In fact, Tom Lawson had been surprised at the tone of her request. It had the murmured, breathless quality of a proposition. Marilyn looked up at him and smiled, and her deep dimples gave her the earnestness of a little girl. "Please," she said, putting her hand on his elbow, "I'd really enjoy doing some more academic work again." Tom Lawson grinned.
"I guess I could use some help," he said. "If your husband doesn't mind, that is. Maybe we could meet and talk about it after New Year's, when term starts."
And Marilyn said, "Yes. Yes, that would be wonderful." James was less enthusiastic. He knew what people would say. He couldn't make enough. His wife had to hire herself out. Years had passed, but he still remembered his mother rising early each morning and donning her uniform. How one winter, when she'd been home from work with the flu for 2 weeks, they'd had to turn off the heat and bundle in double blankets. He remembered how at night his mother would massage oil into her calloused hands, trying to soften them, and his father would leave the room ashamed.
"No," he told Marilyn. "When I get tenure, we'll have all the money we need."
He took her hand, uncurled her fingers, kissed her soft palm.
"Tell me you won't worry about working anymore," he said.
And at last she had agreed. But she kept Tom Lawson's phone number. Then, in the spring, while James, newly tenured, was at work and the children were at school and Marilyn, at home, folded her second load of laundry, the phone rang. A nurse from St. Catherine's Hospital in Virginia, telling her that her mother had died. A stroke. It was April 1st, 1966, and the first thing Marilyn thought was, "What a terrible, tasteless joke." By then, she had not spoken to her mother in almost 8 years, since her wedding day. In all that time, her mother had not written once. When Nath had been born, then Lydia, Marilyn had not informed her mother, had not even sent a photograph. What was there to say? She and James had never discussed what her mother had said about their marriage that last day. "It's not right." She had not ever wanted to think of it again. So when James came home that night, she said simply, "My mother died." Then she turned back to the stove and added, "And the lawn needs mowing." And he understood. They would not talk about it. At dinner, when she told the children that their grandmother had died, Lydia cocked her head and asked, "Are you sad?" Marilyn glanced at her husband. "Yes," she said. "Yes, I am." There were things to be taken care of. Papers to be signed. Burial arrangements to be made. So Marilyn left the children with James and drove to Virginia. She'd long since stopped thinking of it as home. To sort out her mother's things. As mile after mile of Ohio, then West Virginia, streamed past, her daughter's question echoed in her mind. She could not answer for sure. Was she sad? She was more surprised than anything. Surprised at how familiar her mother's house still felt. Even after 8 years, she still remembered exactly how to wiggle the key, down and to the left to get the lock to open. She still remembered the screen door that slowly closed itself with a hiss. The light in the foyer had burned out, and the heavy curtains in the living room were closed. But her feet moved by instinct despite the dark. Years of rehearsal had taught her the dance step around the armchair and the ottoman to the table beside the sofa. Her fingers caught the ribbed switch of the lamp on the first try. It could have been her house. When the light came on, She saw the same shabby furniture she'd grown up with. The same pale lilac wallpaper with a grain like silk. The same china cabinet full of her mother's dolls, whose unblinking eyes gave her the same cold tingle on the back of her neck. On the mantle, the same photographs of her as a child. All the things that she needed to clear away. Was she sad? No. After the day-long drive, only tired.
Many people find this job overwhelming,
the undertaker told her the next morning. He gave her the number of a cleaning company that specialized in making houses ready to sell. Ghouls, Marilyn thought. What a job. Clearing the homes of the dead, piling whole lives into garbage bins and lugging them to the curb. Thank you, she said, lifting her chin. I'd rather take care of it myself. But when she tried to sort her mother's things, she could find nothing she wanted to keep. Her mother's gold ring, her 12 settings of china, the pearl bracelet from Marilyn's father, mementos of an ill-fated wedding day, her demure sweater sets and pencil skirts, the gloves and hat-boxed hats, relics of a corseted existence that Marilyn had always pitied. Her mother had loved her doll collection, but their faces were blank as chalk, white china masks under horsehair wigs, little strangers with cold stares. Marilyn leafed through photo albums for a picture of herself with her mother and couldn't find one. Only Marilyn in kindergarten pigtails. Marilyn in third grade with a missing front tooth. Marilyn at a school party, a paper crown on her head. Marilyn in high school in front of the Christmas tree in a precious Kodachrome. Three photo albums of Marilyn and not a single shot of her mother. As if her mother had never been there. Was she sad? How could she miss her mother when her mother was nowhere to be found? And then, in the kitchen, she discovered her mother's Betty Crocker cookbook, the spine cracking and mended twice with scotch tape. On the first page of the cookie section, a deliberate line in the margin of the introduction, the kind she herself had made in college to mark an important passage. It was no recipe. Always cookies in the cookie jar, the paragraph read. Is there a happier symbol of a friendly house? That was all. Her mother had felt the need to highlight this. Marilyn glanced at the cow-shaped cookie jar on the counter and tried to picture the bottom. The more she thought about it, the less sure she was that she had ever seen it. She flipped through the other chapters, looking for more pencil lines. In pies, she found another. If you care about pleasing a man, bake a pie. But make sure it's a perfect pie. Pity the man who has never come home to a pumpkin or custard pie. Under basic eggs, the man you marry will know the way he likes his eggs. And chances are he'll be fussy about them, so it behooves a good wife to know how to make an egg behave in 6 basic ways. She imagined her mother touching the pencil tip to her tongue, then drawing a careful dark mark down the margin so that she would remember. You'll find your skill with a salad makes its own contribution to the quality of life in your house. Does anything make you feel so pleased with yourself as baking bread? Betty's pickles. Aunt Alice's peach conserve. Mary's mint relish. Is there anything that gives you a deeper sense of satisfaction than a row of shining jars and glasses standing on your shelf? Marilyn looked at Betty Crocker's portrait on the back cover of the cookbook. The faint streaks of gray at her temples. The hair that curled back from her forehead, as if pushed back by the arch of her eyebrow. For a second, It resembled her mother.
Is there anything that gives you a deeper sense of satisfaction?
Certainly, her mother would have said, no, no, no. She thought with sharp and painful pity of her mother, who had planned on a golden, vanilla-scented life but ended up alone, trapped like a fly in this small and sad and empty house. This small and sad and empty life, her daughter gone, no trace of herself left except these pencil-marked dreams. Was she sad? She was angry, furious at the smallness of her mother's life. This, she thought fiercely, touching the cookbook's cover. This is all I need to remember about her. This is all I want to keep. The next morning she called the house cleaning company the undertaker had recommended. The two men who arrived at her door wore blue uniforms, like janitors. They were clean-shaven and courteous. They looked at her with sympathy but said nothing about your loss. With the efficiency of movers, they packed dolls and dishes and clothes into cartons. They swaddled furniture and quilted pads and trundled it to the truck. Where did it go? Marilyn wondered, cradling the cookbook. The mattresses, the photographs, the emptied-out bookshelves. The same place people went when they died. Where everything went. On, away, out of your life. By dinner time, the men had emptied the entire house. One of them tipped his hat to Marilyn. The other gave her a polite little nod. Then they stepped out onto the stoop, and the truck's engine started outside. She moved from room to room, the cookbook tucked under her arm, checking that nothing had been left behind. But the man had been thorough. Her old room was hardly recognizable with the pictures peeled from its walls. The only signs of her time there were the thumbtack holes in the wallpaper, invisible unless you knew where to look. It could have been a stranger's house. Through the open curtains, she could see nothing, only panes of dusk and her face faintly reflected back to her in the glow of the ceiling light. On her way out, she paused in the living room, where the carpet was pockmarked with the ghosts of chair feet, and studied the mantel, now a clean line under a stretch of bare wall. As she pulled onto the highway, heading toward Ohio and home, those empty rooms kept rising in her mind. She swallowed uneasily, pushing the thought aside and pressed the gas pedal harder. Outside Charlottesville, flecks of rain appeared on the windows. Halfway across West Virginia, the rain grew heavy, sheeting the windshield. Marilyn pulled to the roadside and turned off the car. And the wipers stopped mid-sweep, two slashes across the glass. It was past 1 o'clock in the morning and no one else was on the road. No taillights on the horizon, no headlights in the rear view. Only farmland stretching out on either side. She snapped off her own lights and leaned back against the headrest. How good the rain would feel. Like crying all over her body. She thought again of the empty house, a lifetime of possessions now bound for the thrift shop or the garbage dump. Her mother's clothes on some stranger's body, her ring circling some stranger's finger. Only the cookbook beside her at the other end of the front seat had survived. That was the only thing worth keeping. Marilyn reminded herself, the only place in the house there was any trace of her. It struck her then, as if someone had said it aloud. Her mother was dead, and the only thing worth remembering about her in the end was that she had cooked. Marilyn thought uneasily of her own life, of hours spent making breakfasts, serving dinners, packing lunches into neat paper bags. How was it possible to spend so many hours spreading peanut butter across bread? How was it possible to spend so many hours cooking eggs? Sunny side up for James, hard-boiled for Nath, scrambled for Lydia. It behooves a good wife to know how to make an egg behave in 6 basic ways. Was she sad? Yes, she was sad. About the eggs. About everything. She unlocked the door and stepped out onto the asphalt. The noise outside the car was deafening. 1,000,000 marbles hitting 1,000,000 tin roofs. 1,000,000 radios all crackling on the same non-station. By the time she shut the door, she was drenched. She lifted her hair and bowed her head and let the rain soak the curls beneath. The drops smarted against her bare skin. She leaned back on the cooling hood of the car and spread her arms wide, letting the rain needle her all over. Never, she promised herself. I will never end up like that. Under her head, she could hear water thrumming on the steel. Now it sounded like tiny patters of applause, 1,000,000 hands clapping. She opened her mouth and let rain drip into it. Opened her eyes and tried to look straight up into the falling rain. Back in the car, she peeled off her blouse and skirt and stockings and shoes. At the far end of the passenger seat, they made a sad little heap beside the cookbook, like a melting scoop of ice cream. The rain slowed, and the gas pedal was stiff under her bare foot as she coaxed the car into motion. In the rearview mirror, she caught a glimpse of her reflection. And instead of being embarrassed to see herself stripped so naked and vulnerable, she admired the pale gleam of her own skin against the white of her bra. Never, she thought again. I will never end up like that. She drove on into the night, homeward, her hair weeping tiny slow streams down her back. At home, James did not know how to make eggs behave in any way. Each morning, he served the children cereal for breakfast and sent them to school with 30 cents apiece for the lunch line. When is Mom coming home? Nath asked every night, crimping the foil tray of his TV dinner. His mother had been gone for nearly a week, and he longed for hard-boiled eggs again. Soon, James answered. Marilyn had not left the number at her mother's, and anyway, that line would soon be disconnected. Any day now. What shall we do this weekend, hmm? What they did was head to the Y to learn the breaststroke. Lydia hadn't yet learned to swim, so James left her across the street with Mrs. Allen for the afternoon. All week he had looked forward to some father-son time. He had even planned out how he would begin. Keep your arms under water. Whip your legs out. Like this. Although James himself had been a swimmer in high school, he had never won a trophy. He had gone home alone while the others piled into someone's car for celebratory hamburgers and milkshakes. Now he suspected that Nath had the makings of a swimmer, too. He was short, but he was wiry and strong. In last summer's swim class, he had learned the front crawl and the dead man's float. Already he could swim underwater all the way across the pool. In high school, James imagined, Nath would be the star of the team, the collector of trophies, the anchorman in the relay. He would be the one driving everyone to the diner, or wherever kids would go in the far-off 1970s, after meets. That Saturday, when they got to the pool, the shallow end was full of children playing Marco Polo. In the deep end, a pair of elderly men glided in laps. No space for breaststroke lessons yet, James nudged his son. Go in and play with the others until the pool empties out.
Do I have to?
Nath asked, pleating the edge of his towel.